Today is one of those pleasurable days when we don't have the stress and strain of votes. We don't have to debate each other vigorously. I hope not. There are times in this this body when we are becoming informed. And when we held the joint hearing with Commerce and Health and Human Services, there were at least a couple of major topics, I think, that people said we really need to have more time. And I'm happy that we could sort of make a slot, pick one of these meetings and do exactly that. So we have two topics. If you recall, I think we had some sort of thought-stimulating ideas from Dr. McMurray, who's going to have more time today to sort of expound on that. And I'm hoping that Representative Huntley will soon be here, because he was one who sort of said, boy, I really want more time, but I'm sure he'll be here soon. And then we also had, I think, in the whole consumer empowerment world with HRAs and HSAs and that whole alphabet of abbreviations, I think needed more time to sort of sort out where we have been, the tools that have been used, how successful they've been. And then I think the exciting future of what the bill, the Medicare bill, has opened the door in terms of use of HSAs in a broad-based marketplace. So our plan is I think, allow about 45, 50 minutes or so for each of the times, which should give time for your presentation as well as a healthy discussion. So with that, we have a quorum. Well, if we have a quorum, then we'll even do a piece of business, if you don't mind. Representative Huntley moves the minutes of the February 3rd, 2004 Health and Human Services Finance Committee. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. Dr. McMurray, welcome again to the committee, and please proceed.
Thank you, Chairman Bradley. It's my pleasure to return to provide additional information and deeper insights into some of the materials which I shared with you at the time of my last testimony. And once again, I offer whatever assistance I can to the committee and the joint committee as it deliberates. Just again to reintroduce myself, I'm the chief executive of a subsidiary of United Health Group that's called United Resource Networks. We're a company that is focused on catastrophic disease. And have adopted a process that we describe as a center of excellence methodology in order to bring a higher level of quality and cost efficiencies, making better health care more affordable to America. Our background in doing this comes from some basic fundamentals of health care economics and health care practice. Nationally, this is a projection that I have in front of you that was provided by Secretary Donna Shalala just prior to her departure in December of 2000, where it tracked on projections of growth in healthcare expenditures. Here is plotted healthcare expenditures as a proportion of the gross domestic product, showing how much of our nation's economy is consumed with healthcare spending. And projections were created over the course of approximately 80 to 90 years, as you see on the slide. And the projections have been holding up. What it suggests is that about 13 to 14% of the GDP at the time of the study was consumed with healthcare expenditure. But over the course of time, that proportion will grow. And in fact, most recent report shows it just under 15%, right on track with this. One of the things that this research committee that was commissioned by HCFA pointed out was that GDP, I mean, the national health expenditure, will outpace GDP by at least 1%. And much of that increase is due to the inclusion of additional new technologies which are advanced on behalf of people. But that's not the entire story. Much of American healthcare is exposed to some perhaps waste that comes about from variation in performance. As in any industry, variation in performance usually is a, represents some unintended variation reflective of processes that aren't well performed. Let me be a little more specific. This is a map of the United States where a fellow named Dr. Jack Wenberg from Dartmouth analyzed community-to-community variation in the rate of utilization, in this case, something called percutaneous transluminary coronary angioplasty. You're familiar with it as angioplasty. It's the procedure whereby people with heart attacks are treated by having a balloon catheter inserted into the narrowed coronary blood vessel to expand it to provide the heart with additional blood. That procedure, which is in common practice, is practiced at various levels of intensity across the country. This side of the chart demonstrates the variance in the use of this procedure on the basis of the number of procedures performed per 1,000 Medicare beneficiaries. In some communities, as represented by each of these dots, the rate of use is less than 4 per 1,000. In some communities, it's as high as 22 per 1,000. There's a 12-fold difference from the least common community to the highest rate of utilization in community. There is no biological reason for that much variance. Let me try to say that a different way. Your health care in terms of coronary angioplasty is more likely to be determined by your zip code than by the extent of your disease. These changes are idiosyncratic and do not reflect the application of common science for a standard disease process. Medicine is practiced very differently in community to community.
Can you give me a little bit of a sense on the Minnesota portion of that map and what it translates to? It's a little hard to figure.
Yes. Actually, the lighter the color, the less, the lower the utilization rate. And in fact, Minnesota, as typical for a variety of procedures, tends to have lower rates of utilization. There does tend to be more in the way of scientific practice here. You heard Dr. Gordon Mosser speak about ICSI and a variety of other consortia that have been driving more of an evidence-based practice. And Minnesota is an area in which we do tend to have less. If you go into higher detail, we will see that in Rochester, the rates are higher, but those rates are higher because of the attraction that Mayo Clinic has in drawing people from all over the place. So it is a spurious measure. If you look at the state in general, it is relatively low in terms of its utilization, at least as far back as 1996. But this data can be repeated. Different procedures will have different rates of utilization, but in terms of this case, you can see that the darker the color, for instance, here and in parts of Florida, et cetera, you do notice higher rates of utilization. The issue is which one is right, and you can't determine it just from this basic statistical background. You really do have to look at how it's practiced and compare it to what academic medicine is driving as the appropriate clinical response to a given patient presentation. In other words, making sure that the practices are scientific. And when you see this much variation, you have a good sense that it's not. The other things that we can recognize is some change in the way in which healthcare is being covered. We do see, as a result of an aging population, that there will be an increase in the frequency of certain illnesses here. This is looking at cancer. And cancer costs have grown for two reasons. Number one, there's been about a 0.5% increase, at least in commercial populations, in the frequency of cancer, the number of people describing themselves as cancer patients. What's more dramatic, however, as I showed the last time, is that the cost of serving these patients have grown almost 15%. Again, going back to this issue that we described, the variation, if you look at community to community across the United States, and again, this is United Health Group data, and so there won't be Minnesota representation in this. This is United Healthcare health plans across the country. We have noticed big differences in the rates of service apply to communities despite normalizing this data for incidence of disease. So again, the natural habit is for very different levels of practice in community to community. And some of those community differences can be as small as just a matter of zip codes. One of the things that we have also noticed as you dig deeper into this is the cost of technology. Much has been spent to develop drugs, many of which are excellent in the treatment of certain cancers and have advanced the treatment of cancer. But as we look at that expenditure, we also recognize that this growth rate far exceeds any traditional or any other pricing trend that we've seen in general economic patterns. This 29% growth trend that we've recognized when we look at the driving causes does include the cost of these new and more expensive agents, most of which under patent. There's also been a tendency to see increasing administrative costs, even in the physician's office. This is some of the agents that are delivered in a physician's office or in a hospital or in an outpatient setting. And we're watching that the actual cost of delivering these medications are increasing. There's also been, again, this issue of detachment of practice from science, and that we're seeing more in the way of what's called feudal care, care in which there's no predicted benefit from given therapy, but in order to extend one more chance, we'll try to find another agent. There's also billing error and billing abuse, and it just means that wrong bills, whether it's deliberate or not, it still plays a role in this, and that can be corrected. And then finally, misaligned incentives. We're finding that much of the income of oncologists across the country is driven by their ability to deliver these agents in their office, and that has the potential.
Dr. McGarry, is there any significance, do you think, in the last quarter's change in direction of the curve, or is that just a kind of an anomaly?
We believe that to be an anomaly at this point, and it will take time to bear out. As you can see, over the course of time, at any quarter, we do not think that this is clearly a change in the course of treatment. Oh, yeah. Certainly, we do know that over this course of time, there's been even more agents coming into the market, so my suspicion is that this is just the variation from this data sample size. If you were to put all of this together and start looking at what drives healthcare costs in America, I think we're able to settle, we would recognize these things. First, America is aging. The baby boomer population that started to occur when the troops came home in 1946 are now reaching an age in which they need care. It's just that you're aging, particularly in cancer and a variety of other illnesses, is disproportionate on older Americans. And as the age wave migrates, you will see that impact. There's also been continuously accelerating costs, and what I mean by costs here is prices. Despite seemingly immune to any broad economic condition or trend, hospital pricing has outpaced general pricing indexes by a substantial amount. There's also variation in clinical practice, as we've described. And as a result, when you change the way in which you care for a patient, you also change the way in which the patient will recover. And so it's not just a cost issue here, it's also a clinical outcome issue. As new technologies come across the dial, there will be a variety of people who become pioneers and use that technology early, and there will be others that'll take a long time. There's also been a fragmentation of the medical delivery environment. The average practice in America is two docs. We in Minnesota tend to have more in the way of organized practices, but there are still many practices which are singleton. As a result of that, not sharing information systems, there's been discontinuity in the way in which information about a patient traveling from site to site is also moved. Finally, patients are feeling disenfranchised over this model. They don't feel in control. They don't feel that they get to choose who they want. They certainly don't have information to help them choose. And we constantly hear about that. In fact, when you give patients information to make decisions, you can see that the converse, the appreciation that they witness from it. One thing that is good, as I mentioned the last time, is the exceptional clinical capabilities, and Minnesota certainly leads the pack in this. And in terms of its abilities and technologies in the hands of highly talented physicians, there is not a lack of capability. But the issue between could we do something and should we do something is still a gap. The medical establishment, the practicing medical establishment, and its economic establishment, as voiced through the Institute of Medicine, has tried to bring focus to this through some reports that came through the Institute of Medicine, first highlighting, as people probably remember, the issue of patient safety, 48 to 98,000 deaths in America caused by accidents in hospitals. Understanding likewise in their second report that the gap between, that the distance between what people could get in healthcare versus what they are getting in healthcare in terms of quality is not a gap but a chasm. And the Institute went on to make some recommendations in its next report in helping decide what to start focusing on so we can start crossing that chasm. As I said the last time, there are four things to focus on. The first of which is establishing evidence-based medicine as the standard of care. Second was to start using better, to the advantage of the patient, the massive available data that's generated day-to-day in the doctor's office to improve care. Third is, as you hear in the next testimony, is the use of a consumer-centric tool, the Centers of Excellence environment, where patients take command of their destiny and choose people who deserve the privilege and responsibility for serving them, and allow market forces to drive it. And then finally, to install patient advocate systems which support patient decisions and facilitate conduct of care. Let me describe what I mean by these things, but certainly before I leave this is the big point on top. This isn't an issue of throwing more money at the system. It's really fundamental repairs to the systems of care. To the first recommendation, providing more evidence, we spend quite a bit of time, and twice a year we send out 500,000 copies of this textbook to docs across the country. The textbook is a critical appraisal of all therapies for common diseases to show their relative capability in solving that patient's problem. It's described as evidence-based medicine. Essentially what it points out, for a variety of common conditions, these are the things that have proven themselves to work, and these are the things that are unproven, and some of the things that are harmful. We put that in the hands of every doc, but we also found it necessary to put it in the hands of every patient. And through their internet portals and through direct mailings and the like, we send out identical content written in a way so that it's understandable, so that in the course of the patient and physician contact in the exam room, somebody is likely to have read what to do about this condition. And it can engender the dialogue. We can also look at claims data. For instance, to examine as claims are sent in to us for payment, we can recognize that the claim is coming from one of our clients who's a woman, who's above age 50, and therefore should have an annual mammogram according to the U.S. Preventive Task Force and even ICSI guidelines. And what we're able to do is that if we look in that patient's history of claims and we don't see a mammogram, we'll notify two people. We'll notify the treating physician and we'll notify the patient that we haven't seen a claim. And it may be something you need to discuss with your doctor if you haven't had a mammogram. Do the same thing with cervical pap smears for cervical cancer detection, colon cancer screening, diabetes management, and a variety of other things. And as you can see, the impact of sharing that information both with patient and with physician is the steady increase in the use of those procedures. Essentially, what we are looking at is looking at our claims history to identify any potential errors of omission in care. These are actually places where we're telling people to please come in and get more care because these interventions are meaningful for them. We can also do the opposite. Last year, the New England Journal of Medicine dispelled a myth in medicine, and orthopedic surgery in particular, that taking an arthroscope and simply washing out a knee that has osteoarthritis was of benefit. It was happening a lot around the country. In fact, the New England Journal article published last February said it was in fact harmful. We went to each of our physicians that have, that are orthopedic surgeons in our community and sent out the article as well as their claims history in terms of how many times they had seen patients with osteoarthritis and for what proportion of those patients did they do one of these arthroscopic called lavage or washout. When we contacted doctors, we were successful in contacting the doctors, and then we repeated the study, we saw a 22% decrease in the application of this service. Docs were paying attention to the article. For docs that we didn't contact or were unable to contact, what we were able to recognize is that the practice actually increased the use of this service, which was disproven as an effective form of therapy. So again, you can use claims history generated as routine parts of care to even look for these, what would be described as areas of commission in care.
Dr. McNeil, if I may, you may sort of get into this, but sort of at the core of this is the notion of what's called evidence-based medicine or best practices or those kinds of things. So first of all, just to make sure we understand, because I think there is confusion amongst policymakers of ranging all the way from some sort of rationing system that's viewed that Oregon has to some of the examples that you've given. So I want to be sure, kind of help us with what definition, and I have a kind of a follow-up question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Let me go back and spend a little more time on that. This is one of several qualified sources of evidence-based medicine. What evidence-based medicine is a strict criteria that is driven by scientists. It is not driven by insurance companies. It is not driven by policymakers. It is not up for vote by the public the public sector or patients. What this is are research tools, and I'll be glad to provide the committee with copies of its most recent version to get a familiarity with it. But it is actually looking at research papers, grading those research papers for their credibility, whether they came from the New England Journal of Medicine and other credible referred journals, whether they were large population-based studies, whether there was good statistical rigor, and then looking at the conclusions of those studies to determine whether or not a given form of therapy for a specific condition is appropriate. It is published here, this particular device is published, this particular vehicle is published by the British Medical Journal. And the British Medical Journal is certainly beyond repute. It is the New England Journal, or the Annals of Internal Medicine for Britain. But it also, this also is a worldwide journal, and many of the participants in its editorial board are Americans. Many of the studies that are quoted here are done in this country. It is a scientifically based grading system where they can look at, and they are able to describe treatments as being absolutely predictive of a good outcome, things that are questionable, things that are unlikely to be of help, and then things that are harmful. So it is statistically driven, it is scientifically merited, and it is driven by the academic scientists.
And Dr. Mignoli, as sort of a follow-up to that, because we've tried in a bill that some of us have put together to sort of include notions about best practices, and I really do genuinely struggle about, I mean, I don't want to, in statute, try to articulate an ever-changing market in terms of what is best practices, like you just gave us the example about the knee surgery. But to give some validity to it, it seems like you sort of need to point to something. And I'm struggling a little bit about, you've given us an example here, I've thought about do we choose ICSI and what ICSI's done. Is there, if you're giving advice to the legislature of trying to, first of all, identify the right place to point for legitimate evidence-based best practices. Any suggestions?
Mr. Chairman, the ways that there are several sources of evidence-based medicine that are credible. There are also things that present themselves as evidence-based medicine with less credibility. Certainly the Riggs, I'm familiar with ICSI, having participated personally myself. Having worked with that organization, I understand the rigor and the integrity that Dr. Massa brings to that in his leadership. And certainly that is a potential vehicle for the committee to consider. But I do advise that if that is something that is pursued within the state, that there is some body of scientists within the state that provide credibility so that the broader public recognizes that whatever sources are used, even if this committee wasn't there for this panel that you have, wasn't there for the purpose of reviewing the science, that certainly they could at least credential the sources of that material. There may be several very good ways to treat something, and different sources of evidence-based medicine may point to different ways, but each are credible in that they are scientifically driven. My recommendation is that if you are to consider something within your legislation, that perhaps something rooted within the state of Minnesota itself from your leading, from your thought leaders in this environment, to at least certify that the materials from any given organization, be it the British Medical Journal, be it ICSI, or anybody else, passes a rigorous credentialing process.
I think maybe not taking too much time in the committee now, but Dr. McGillivray, if you're able to, I think we could use some advice in this area, maybe a follow-up discussion. And then finally, on this whole thing, once you identify it, then it's the impatience that I have, and I hope a lot of us have, to say, you know, why in the world are there all those variations, even within Minnesota, where it doesn't make sense, where it's controllable? So how do you accelerate it? Any thoughts there?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, doctors in Minnesota and across the country are facing two challenges, one of which is keeping up with their ever-expanding knowledge base. The turn of the last century, the doubling time for medical knowledge was estimated to be in excess of a decade. Now it's in a matter of months. The amount of research and the capabilities of research and the technology that supports that research allows us to grow in our understanding of healthcare all the more, and it's to the talent and it's to the credit of the scientific and practicing community. But as that information comes forward, the learning time, the adoption rates, etc., are highly varied. And it is hard for a doc who is trying to build his knowledge base to also keep up with their patient base. And they're competing for that. And one of the problems has been is that most of healthcare knowledge has been traditional. It's most intense in medical school, becomes somewhat less intense through residency and clinical rounds. And then as one gets into private practice and all, it becomes harder because you have multiple competing influences to keep up. And docs do a very good job of it, but the technologies to support it, for instance, providing bedside decision support tools so the doc is always current with things that are rapidly changing. And I think that's where maybe some investment should be made, is in the support of helping docs stay current. It's not that they want to practice in a different way. There may be some, but those are the rare exceptions, and they stick out like a sore thumb. It is really a matter of translating knowledge into practice.
Representative Aber.
Thanks. I'm trying to suppress my questions, Mr. Chair, but I just have to ask at least one or two, just if only to offer this. This is a very keen interest of area of interest for me, or area of keen interest. For one thing, do you have a copy of that book that you were talking about?
I would be glad to provide every member of the Joint Committee a copy of that book, and I'll take it and send it through.
Mr. and Dr., just another thought. I think you're on the right track with this deal about this. The whole thing about doing what works and not doing what doesn't work seems to make just great sense, and watching for regional variations by zip code, for heaven's sakes. As you do, I have a concern, though, in this, and it's friendly concern. I'm a practicing chiropractor. You may not know that. And 25 years, and so whatever that means to it, that already conjures up an impression. However, being in the alternative healthcare arena, in many areas, we are indeed the low-cost provider and have extremely good results. In some areas, our results are poor, as is true of any health park. Is there some way, as we look at this evidence base, to look at the alternative world, not just in my profession, but in homeopathy, what's done in Germany, what's done in Spain that might work better? Maybe there's some little root over in Guyana that works for about a dollar that would save something we spent $8,000 on, but has been suppressed because some people who make $8,000 don't want that root to come here. How do you handle that? There's two parts, and I'll just actually summarize. What about suppressed things we know and stuff we don't know? How do you get that in emerging techniques? How do you get that into this to actually do the best?
Dr. McGillivray.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman and Representative, the chiropractic is no different than the other professions of medicine. For instance, one particular organization within United Health Group, another similar company similar to mine, manages chiropractic and complementary medicine. In the course of its management, it does share best practices amongst the chiropractic community, and those practices should be no different than what happens for similar types of services, irrespective of what the initials are following the name of the professional. And we share those practices, and we use tools such as this, looking at claims history, to look at people who are practicing with variants and try to move them to those docs that are practicing at a more scientifically based. All forms of professional medicine, be it chiropractic, homeopathy, or allopathic medicine, if you will, have a need to continue to expand that base of science, and we are seeing quite a bit of interest in the fields of alternative care and chiropractic in terms of generating that science, and it's reassuring to see. But certainly can be measured just the same way, using claims and a variety of other bases to do this.
And Dr. Mavioli, I think one of the dilemmas, though, is where it comes together. It's one thing to think independently of chiropractic and standard physician-based medicine, but I think you know as well as all of us, is some of the intersections have been a little bit tricky. So how in terms of best practices, when you say, well, it would be better actually to go to a chiropractor than it would be to go to a lower back physician or something. I don't know if I'm stating that, but is that a favor? I'm sorry, Dr. McGillivray.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I'm not stating that it's better to go to chiropractic or not. I'm saying wherever the patient elects to go, it should be the science that drives whatever happens in that environment. And certainly many of these, the chiropractor that practices in the state is licensed to do many of these therapies. And if they're licensed to do it and the patient presents, then it should be the science that drives it, not the licensed capability of the individual. The second point to that relates to the issues that have stovepiped scientific thought within medicine, whether it's allopathic medicine or alternative or complementary medicine of any sort, has come about because of the guild notion of much of the scientific generation. In fact, we believe that if you take a more patient perspective about, I have a problem, what are the things that can be done, and then look at, well, geez, who's licensed to do this type of work and who is credentialed to do this type of work, that should drive decisions. And so it really has to be a patient perspective that drives even the generation of the science that we have.
Well, just to expand your thought, and not to be just to help this out, and the word is politics, medical politics, using the entire spectrum of healthcare is it's about money sometimes. And if we're truly interested, now it didn't matter before because there was plenty of money and rates were low, but now rates are high and we're not getting the outcomes. The outcomes in this country don't measure the money we spend. And what if there were a best way to do it that didn't involve that was not popular with the allopathic community, for instance, this root from Guyana that I made up, that would solve it, and it would cost the hospital $8,000, and they were disinclined to lose $8,000. How do you handle that, getting people that don't want to lose that money to do the best thing for the person. That's a kind of a, just a neutral example I made up, but it illustrates the dilemma. And that's what Representative Bradley was getting at, is how do you do the interface and get behaviors to change in the face of an economic disincentive?
Dr. McNally?
Good luck, Mr. Chairman. No answers are simple, but let me try. The issues around economics and outcomes, I think, will be driven in a market in which free market forces are allowed to drive that kind of behavior. But in order for it to be a good free market environment, you do need to have the full spectrum of things that make it an efficient marketplace, one of which is knowledge of the outcomes, knowledge of the capabilities of that provider, and the knowledge of the price tag, and then let people decide. I think that kind of natural market force will help drive that mingling. In fact, when we get to talk about centers of excellence, that's much of that notion.
Yeah. And with that, perhaps it's a good segue, because I think we're down to maybe 15 minutes or so more, and that's our fault for asking questions here. So let's allow you to proceed, please.
Let me move on to this, right to that notion, then. The centers of excellence model. The centers of excellence model is really a free market model of healthcare. It is not much different than what some of the novel experiments that were done here by the Bios Healthcare Action Group several years ago. It just happens to be more fortified with better technology for tracking outcomes. Essentially, what it does is it stratifies performance of individual professionals or institutions that render care. And by stratifying it, it then makes it available to the public. It also takes advantage of the fact that there are a certain level of qualifiers, given that there is a certain level of experience and outcome that is worth having within the network. And then, on the basis of being able to collectively purchase, and in our case, we purchase on behalf of 44 million Americans, we're able to get pretty good negotiated rates across the country. So now we are able to provide an environment in which we're able to identify the best and the brightest, and as well provide collective purchasing power on behalf of people to go out and get their best rates. And it allows, and it empowers patients using these information systems and our nursing staff to pick the right center for their needs, used on their basis of understanding of value. It's essentially putting patients in control of the healthcare delivery environment.
Excuse me, Dr. I think Representative Tremba had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is, how can it be a market-driven market when the consumer chooses to do homeopath and yet can't be reimbursed in their health plan and not even in their flex plan unless they get a physician's okay? I know I'm going back to where it was, but that's confusing to me. Because we're trying to be so consumer driven, but yet when we choose something that maybe is less, and they've made that choice, we don't fit into the system.
Dr. McGlory, right.
Mr. Chairman and Representative, the ability to include homeopathic coverage in a health decision model, if there is going to be an insured basis, right now is driven on the basis of the employer's appetite for including that as part of their benefits set. It's more and more those types of programs are available, and it is a matter of appetite to include that. At this point in time, such open market efforts are going to be hampered by the fact that outcomes data for a homeopath versus outcomes data for an allopathic physician versus a chiropractor versus a nurse practitioner are not readily available. And so right now it's a matter of the doctors or professionals being able to convey with their best efforts the results of their performance. What is needed is a better understanding of the outcomes. And I would suggest that if you were to focus on outcomes, that you do as we have learned, which is to start with the most common or most prevailing things, low back pain, for instance, and a variety of other common conditions, whereby we could potentially measure what people's return to function are, what level of comfort they're having, and then trace it back to who provided it and how they provided it. The science is lacking, as is the outcome measures, and what I'm encouraging is you put that kind of thing into a model that those kinds of information sets are also built at the same time.
Well,
Representative Trumbo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But we're talking about a consumer-driven health care, and many times if it's not covered, they will choose the expensive health care even though they want to do the other. And so it kind of drives costs in a backdoor way. That's just an editorial comment,
Representative Wilkin, did you have a comment to this point?
Comment, Mr. Chairman, to Representative Tremba. That's exactly what the HSAs do. They put the consumer in total control of that part of their health care, and they can choose the homeopathic way, or they can choose chiropractor, they can choose whatever they want. It's their decision, not the health plan.
Dr. McNeil, you have a response?
Yes, Mr. Chairman and Representative Trumbo. I would also recognize that the market forces have also allowed more and more companies to offer an insured product for homeopathy as well as alternative care because the market has demanded it.
Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Richard.
Thank you.
I don't know why I don't get the Smith and Johnson names, you know. Just a comment with a question into it is, as we move more from an art to a science in medicine, doesn't that just innately raise the costs?
Dr. McGorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative. I would contend, in fact, that it does just the opposite. American health care will become more expensive naturally. The quality of that health care has improved. The things considered today to be standard of care, things considered to be standard of care mere 5 years ago would be insufficient now, as we've learned more about the human body, about technology, about the way to treat those things. So there will be a natural driving force that healthcare will get better over time, and that's a good thing. What we want to do, though, is to eliminate the waste that occurs when those new technologies are either used inappropriately or used in a way in which does not bring help to that patient. And so that, for that reason, we have strongly advocated the role of increasing the pressure of science within the American practice. And for that reason, those 500,000 books that we send out to docs across the country, we do send out at our cost. The docs do not buy those. It's that we feel that strongly that providing science to the field will have that kind of return.
Okay, Representative, you're going to follow up?
No, thank you, Mr.
Okay,
Chair.
Good. We need to move on. Representative Otremba.
This is a kind of a comment for Representative Wilkin, but alternative care benefits are not deductible unless they're okayed by your insurance plan in an HRA. And also in your flex plans, unless you have a doctor's okay prescription for them, you cannot use them in your savings account or deduct them in your flex plan. I mean, that was just my reaction.
Yeah. Can I suggest our next presentation, I think, can sort of deal more in this, so why don't we defer that? Representative Aper?
No.
Okay. Dr. McGlory, please proceed.
If you're going to examine health care, you really do have to. If you're going to have centers of excellence, it does have to be defined by the patient. It's not the role of a doc to define excellence. It's not the role of a payer to define excellence. You really have to be able to address patients' needs in terms of their understanding of how fast you'll treat them, how effectively you'll treat them, how comfortable will it be, and how much will it cost me. And those are the things that we use as our driving forces. For the purpose of time, I'll allow you to I think the comments that I have are pretty well described in these bullet points, and this, they're pretty evident. When you start looking at that variation across the country, you can define it for any condition on a statistical basis. If you measure quality using what the Institute of Medicine has used as its measures of quality, the same things that I talked about on the previous slide, you can measure those people that do this on an average basis, those people who are outliers and do it exceptionally well, and those people who are poor performers. You can also look at healthcare as a continuum of disease states, which on the basis of their frequency and their complexity are also on a spectrum. The area that we focus on is this rare and complex condition. Healthcare is traditionally practiced in this environment. Most of the conditions that we see, just by nature of their frequency, tend to have broad experience. They tend to occur in community settings, tend to have minimal complexity, tend to have a lower case cost, and patients really have self-directed access. Where we focused our business was on the complex conditions, those things that there's not a lot of experience to go around, tends to be at academic institutions, tend to require sophisticated guidance, tend to be very expensive on an individual basis, and patients are more accepting of professional guidance. Things that we're talking about here is congenital heart disease, kids born with bad hearts, diseases in which transplants are necessary, and diseases in which result in a complex cancer. Doesn't mean that what we're doing here does not apply here. It's just that right now, based on what's available, we have to take two different approaches. In the case of the common conditions, what we've been finding we need to do is to use those information tools that we have. And we're going to have more opportunity to do this as those information sets get better, as we start measuring outcomes and able to coordinate cases so we can tell every patient and every doc where they've missed things and also show patients and docs when things aren't necessary. But when we get to the area that we serve, there's not enough cases to go around, and it's better yet that you rescue those people out of the hands of people who don't have experience and shift those patients to practices which generally practice at this level. In other words, to identify the best and the brightest and send all patients there. That's what we would recommend for cases in which there is not broad experience in the treatment of these patients. Here's a case in point. Here's heart transplantation around this country. There's 139 places around America to practice heart transplant. And as I said the last time, these black and pink triangles are our institutions. There are several other institutions that we've recognized when you look at how readily patients survive these diseases versus how many they've done. That shows that there's still variation even at this level of care. There's nothing stopping people from walking into this place that did six of these cases and didn't have a single survivor. In fact, by using these models where you're starting to identify for the community those people that do it well, you can get a shift, and as much as a 22% advantage for going into one of these black and pink triangles versus going into those other centers. The other thing that this does is allows us to go to these centers and say, we will send you cases. In return, we would like a better rate for those services. And those rates are rather significant. We're able to out-surpass regular health plans in the rates for these complex services, largely because we can focus the attention of 44 million Americans to these centers. By the way, the University of Minnesota is, as well as Mayo Clinic, are represented in various of our programs for these things. Minnesota has a good tradition of having these institutions. The things that we do in order to make these centers, though, that are very important are to make sure, number one, that you're able to identify the best and the brightest, and you do need outcomes data. And that's going to be a limitation for some of the less complex disease where attention hasn't been paid to getting good data. Second is to be able to go out and get good discounts on behalf of large group. And then third is to bring in people that can help patients make decisions. Because many times patients aren't capable on their own in order to do these decisions themselves. In fact, what happens is that even if you are able to build these networks, patients, when they're sick, are unlikely to look at that data on their own or to understand it, or to trust their own interpretation of it, and that's what we can do. And that's what we spend most of our time doing.
In terms of how this is done, then, are you saying that you you have this kind of information available to the patient as well as, the plan, of course, and the patient ultimately makes a decision, or does the plan make a decision?
Yeah, we'll go, and the patient will typically present with, I have this problem, I've been told I should go to this place, what should I do? And what we do with them is to show them the data of the institution that they brought, as well as several other institutions, and show them those issues that I mentioned before. What are the waiting times at those institutions? What is their historical success rates? What have people said about their comfort level in having it done at that institution? And then what's the price tag going to be? With that kind of information, 91% of the time, people will go to one of our centers. It is, it will give them a whole choice, including the ability to go to the center they came up with. It may be out of network, but their insurance benefits do provide some financial coverage for it. But what this provides is a real methodology by which the patient is in command of making these decisions.
Dr. Mignoli, if we can, I'd like to sort of try to wrap it in about 5 minutes or so, if we can accelerate.
Right. Let me just give you a couple of other things. This is something that could happen here, but this is in the city of New York. We were able to measure cancer outcome rates and hospitals in terms of how long patients are in the hospital, in other words, a measure of efficiency and cost versus survivorship of the procedure, clinical quality. You can see that some of these centers stick way out as being excellent. This is Memorial Sloan Kettering. This is everybody else in the marketplace. Patients walking around on their own that walk into this facility, which has a higher mortality and a longer length of stay, probably because of complication rates, does not tell the patient that as they enter that door. And that's what the importance is, and I would highly recommend that a deeper commitment be made to measuring these types of outcomes to allow people to make these decisions. Given that kind of information, people will migrate to this quadrant. You can show the same things we said in the past about congenital heart disease. This is several pages down. These are kids born with life-threatening heart problems. And what we're finding is that there are just a handful of centers across the country that do this well. And you can see that they do it well as compared to everybody else. These are a variety of different types of operations listed here. And one of the things that you notice is that these institutions that contract with us on the basis of their performance do more and have better results. But the other thing that they have is half the time spent in the hospital. Again, when people do this stuff all the time and they're expert at it, they have no complications. Things move along, the hospitals are set up. In that impact, and maybe I should finish off with this slide, is to give you some confidence in this. United Health Group used to typically get a $273,000 bill for kids with these conditions. With their best contracting efforts, they were able to get a discount to get the price down to $191,000. But when we started shipping these children to these institutions that do this well and have proven benefit, we not only had better results clinically, we were also able to get smaller bills. We were able to take out $85,000 out of the average bill. Why? Because the child was in the hospital less. The other thing, because we're able to buy an aggregate for large groups of people, we get additional discounts. And the net impact was to take this payment level and cut it in half.
All right, Dr. McNair, just as an editorial comment, this is a very striking case to support your assertion before that it can be that cost and value actually improves with quality. Very striking.
The value that we have in this community is there are outstanding institutions scattered around the state of Minnesota. I know I've practiced here. Yeah. And the ability to generate this data is real. Experiments have been conducted here in the past that were promising. I think those experiments need to go further, the BioSoftware Action Group and the like. Giving people the choice to be able to identify these institutions and then to take it to a level.
You sort of gave us a picture as far as the patient behavior and the response of 91% of them. What about the behavior of the networks and the hospitals and so forth? Because I would think that this might also be an incentive for some of them who are in the wrong quadrants of some of your charts to do things to change.
Mr. Chairman, let me relate my own personal experience. I was president of Park Nicollet Clinic at one time, but before that, my better role was when I was a practicing surgeon there. When the Bias Healthcare Action Group and the work that was then administered by Health Partners established that we were going to put your results online. Actually, at that point, it was in kiosks because we didn't have the online technology. We're going to let the patient see your results. At first, it made me panic. But then it also turned around and helped me recognize that this was an opportunity for me to distinguish myself, because as I would walk out of my exam room, I would see three people on each side of me that did the same job I did. And I looked at the ability to share data with the patient as a way of distinguishing myself. It made me focus more on how I was doing things, to look to scientific guidance to say what has been proven to do this better, because I knew now I was competing for market share of patients. And so I absolutely agree with your contention. When you have this type of visibility of performance in the eyes of the patient, it really captures the minds and the hearts of those people who are providing care.
Representative Huntley, I'm amazed you've been just sitting there. You got anything to say?
Well, I could read what I wrote on the first page here. I said, this guy is really good. I just wanted to compliment him, and it's certainly a pleasure to hear him talk at a normal speed, unlike the previous time we had to listen to him.
Exactly. Yeah.
But I did have a question. In order to get all this information, somebody in the, your case, United Healthcare Health Plan is looking at these patients' records, and you have to look at individual records. Do the patients have to sign off to allow somebody besides their physician to look at those records, and how do you handle that privacy problem?
Dr. McGlory?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Huntley, that is a very good question. The records we see are not the individual physician case records. We do not need to look at a chart to get an individual case record. What we do is that have been submitted to us in the course of providing care, and just from interpreting the bill, we do disclose that when patients sign up with us, and we encourage its use because we use it on their behalf. But this is data that they actually send to us for us to pay their bill. And that's how they and that's how we approach it. We do not have to go into the record. The information that I share here about the performance of individual institutions is collected through a variety of ways. Many times it's done by survey, and in there, when we operate those surveys, the identity of patients and private patient information is withheld from us. We do not have a need for it. We're looking for aggregate data. Likewise, much of the data that we can get is also provided through public sources. For instance, transplant data that I showed here is provided through the Department of Health and Human Services, and it's available to anybody that wants to look at it. It's on ustransplant.org as a site, and you can see how you can compare individual institutions. What we do is we aggregate that blinded data. Very rarely when we look at performance do we ever have to look at private patient performance, and the most of the data that we get that's private we get right from the patient themselves as a result of our case management. They will call us in order to get help. In order for us to help them, we ask them questions that they volunteer the answer for. So there's really not a reason for us to get into individual private information. The only place where we use private information from claims data is when we are trying to encourage people to get their mammograms, trying to encourage people to get their cervical pap smears, when we're trying to get them to get their colonoscopies.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair and Dr. Mingliari, so that sometimes, for instance, the pap smears and the mammograms, you do get down to the level of the patient.
Dr. McGlory.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Huntley, The way in which that is operated is the we will look at a doctor's practice and pull up all women above a given age based on the criteria set by the U.S. Preventive Task System. The patient signs off on this kind of activity when they sign up for their insurance policy, that we will use their claims data in a secure fashion to be shared only with them and their doctor on behalf of their care. And so what we will do with that information is we'll identify that Mrs. Jones is 50 years old, and we do not see in the last 12 months a claim from on Mrs. Jones' behalf for a mammogram. We'll send Mrs. Jones a card. We'll actually send her a card encouraging her. So we have not seen a mammogram, and you should talk to your doctor about it. We will also go back to the doctor that sent us the bill and show them all the patients in their practice that are women over age 50 for whom they have not had a mammogram bill submitted in the last year, so that the doctors can call the patient. It's actually a way we believe that we can build the relationship between doctor and patient.
Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. McInerney, I deeply appreciate what you've done today in further enlightening us, and thank you for coming, and I hope that you wouldn't mind if we need to seek some advice. We may contact you as we continue our work. I would also acknowledge to members that although this is really wonderful work, it's not the only work going on in the industry. There are some things. I think in your packet, for example, and I wish we'd have had time, but the Minnesota Council of Health Plans has kind of an outline of the Minnesota Community Measurement Project. We're also getting, I think, from Medica, reimbursing physicians for quality. I just got something recently from Health Partners, which I think shows they're a very broad-based initiative in many ways similar to some of the things that you're talking about. I'm very encouraged that you're seeing it now coming from all sectors, and I think particularly to see health plans saying, we know we have to do it differently, and we have a strong role. It's nice to see those things happening. I'm just an impatient engineer wanting it to be everywhere. Thank you very much, Dr. McGlory.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members of the committee.
Now we'll move into the presentation from Ms. Sheffield and Mr. Kribe on some backgrounds. I've had a chance to visit with this group, and actually they did present at our previous one, but frankly we were so squeezed on time that I felt like we should talk further. And my hope is sort of that we, one, get a bit of a background. The tools for consumer empowerment are not brand new. We have had medical savings accounts. We've had tools like health reimbursement accounts. And this company has certainly, in my opinion, applied in very creative ways, particularly the use of health reimbursement accounts. But I think the other thing that I hope that you'll be able to share with us is sort of a look-see to the future of how you view and what are some of the characteristics of the health savings account and how that might further enhance the consumer empowerment. So having presented half your presentation, not at all, I'm sorry. But welcome to the committee. If you would please introduce yourselves as we begin for the day.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jim Prevey, and I'm the Executive Vice President at Sheffield Olsen & McQueen.
And I'm Cindy Sheffield, the President of Sheffield Olsen & McQueen.
Welcome.
Just a little background quick. Sheffield Olsen & McQueen is a third-party administrator located here in St. Paul, and we've been working with organizations for over 23 years now with benefit plan needs and administration. So just quick background on what we are. We're going to talk about, and I thank you for having us back today to talk a little bit more and hopefully help educate you a little bit more on the consumer-directed models that are out there. One of the things we want to talk about is there's the new model with the HRAs, and there's a lot of different terminology out there, and just make sure that everyone understands that when they hear consumer-driven health care or defined contribution health plans, consumer-directed or HRAs 105, personal health accounts, PHF, all kinds of different terminology, they all basically mean the same thing and fall under the same guidance. We're going to start first with what is an HRA? And we'll kind of get basic with it, but it's an arrangement that is funded solely by an employer, not an employee. So that's a big thing to remember in the HRA world, that it is employer dollars only and not employee dollars. And the employers own those accounts and are set up for employees to use while they are employees of that employer. They pay as or reimburses the participant for eligible medical expenses as defined under section IRS section 213D, which are incurred by a participant or an employee or a former employee that may be under COBRA or an employee, spouse, or dependent, and those are defined under code section 152. It provides payments or reimbursements up to a maximum dollar amount set for a specific period of coverage. Typically, it's for any unused amounts at the end of the year can be carried forward on a tax-free basis to increase the amount, the maximum amount to be paid or reimbursed in subsequent coverage periods. So to sum that up, what that means is that what it's doing is providing reimbursements for covered eligible expenses under a medical plan that may not be covered under your health plan. And then it's also providing incentives on a tax-free basis for employers to establish accounts for employees to grow those dollars to help cover them for uncovered expenses in future years. If all the rules are satisfied, the payments are and reimbursements are generally excludable from gross income under codes 105 and 106. Some of the tax issues and tax savings available at the employer and the employee's level. It's a vehicle in which we can transform taxable income into tax-free income for both employers and employees, and we'll talk a little bit about that. Save employment tax for the employer and the employee as well as income tax. HRA plans are subject to 105H, the non-discrimination requirement, prohibiting discrimination in favor of highly compensated employees. Some of the goals, when we look at the goals of setting up the HRA model and what we want to accomplish within an HRA model, is really to engage consumers in health care purchasing decisions by giving them a stake in their health plan, really changing behavior from the current model. Create a market within the provider community and promote cost disclosure so people can start to understand what it costs to go to the doctor, how much tests cost and procedures cost, and start having those communications with the providers, and then overall reduce premium costs. The Center for Disease Control published this and was really the determining factors of healthcare and the drivers of healthcare demand. And if you'll notice, the number one is behavior. 50% of why people always go to the doctor is behavior, and we talk about it a lot in our own organization. We talked about we our building, and we have a Fairview Clinic right below us, and our utilization at that Fairview Clinic was enormous. We were to the point where we went down there and almost wanted to negotiate a deal with them because we had so much utilization from our employees going down to Fairview, and they were on a $10 copay plan, so it was really easy for them. You know, we had not only access to care, we had in behavior, they were all the tools were right there for them to go down. So if someone was sitting at their computer all day, had a minor headache, they might go down to the doctor, those type of things. We switched over to an HRA plan model for our own employees a year ago now, and have gone through a complete year with that. And utilization at that Fairview Clinic has dropped dramatically. We hear people now talking about calling the nurse lines, finding things out instead of just running downstairs to the doctor, because now they realize that some of those dollars are theirs and they have the ability to participate in that health care. They just don't go pay $10 and be done with it. So behavior is the number one thing, and it's really what the goal of this is, to try to change people's behavior and engage them in their health care buying decisions. Provider cost disclosures is another goal, and it's giving the power back to the providers to set their price, not HMOs or PPOs going in with set negotiated contracts and those type of things, and controlling the people with the price and volume. And it's giving back the power to providers to manage patient care, so that they can engage in with the patient and manage that care with them, and both from a care model and a financial model. And freedom for people to choose and make provider decisions based on price and value, much like we do everything else in our society. We base things on price and value. The majority, the majority of participants have non-arts claims which total less than $1,000 in a typical year. And that kind of addresses that the 80-20 rule that we'll talk a little bit more about. But typically what you see is you have a small percentage of the population in a health plan that's using a majority of the dollars, and a large percentage of the participants in a health plan using a small amount of the health care dollars. This is a real example, and we use these models for our employers, groups that we administer their benefits on, and we run these models of data to go out there when we talk about converting to an HRA plan or a high deductible type model with an HRA, and look at the distribution of non-RX claims for a client. And this was an actual example of a claim, but when we run this over and over, we see the same type of model, and it holds true to that 80-20 rule where most claims are falling below $1,000 or $2,000 within a health plan. Why the HRA model? It's a marketplace reality. Healthcare costs are projected to increase dramatically over the next 3 to 5 years. We all know that. Direct to the consumer RX advertising, over-the-counter drug migration, and the consolidation of the PBM marketplace are huge. People are being educated more and more through advertisements, through the internet, those type of things. Everyone's seen the commercials for the purple pill. Does everyone really know what the purple pill does? But they go to the doctor and want to ask for that purple pill. So there's a lot of direct-to-consumer advertising and need vehicles to be able to educate the people on those things. The benefits of managed care have run their course. There are some regional exceptions to that, but for the most part have run their course. With poor economic and focus on cost control and shifting is another reason why this is becoming more of a reality. And plan participants really view benefits as an entitlement and a commodity, and we've trained them well. And more I hear a lot of conversations with employees that we go in and we talk to employers, and we've had it at our own organization. Employees say, well, I was just doing what they told me to do. You know, 15 years ago, someone came into our office and we had our health plan meeting, and they told us to go to the doctor for everything, and it would only cost us $10, and to go and to go and to go. And so I'm just doing what they've told us to do, and now you're telling me not to do that and to be engaged in what I'm doing and understand costs and those type of things. So we've done a good job at training people just to say, go to the doctor for $10, and that's been the model that's been out there for years. The current benefit system, we believe, is kind of illogical. Current copay plans really foster a disconnect between the consumer and the real cost of care. Again, it gets back to that model of, I pay $10, that's all it costs me to go to the doctor, and what is it really costing to go to the doctor? Is that office visit $102, $120, or is it just, in my opinion, $10? So many times we'll sit in front of employees and employee focus groups at employers or employment meetings, we'll ask the question, how much does it cost you to go to the doctor? How much does it cost to go to the doctor? And most of the time people raise their hand and say $15 or $20. People out there don't get, they don't understand exactly how much it costs to go to the doctor. They always relate it back to what it costs them to go to the doctor. Plan participants right now really have no real economic stake in making good decisions in their health care. Most health plans now today are use it or lose it type plans. And the status quo, you know, as inflation periods, inflation goes up, we have a leveraging, and we'll talk a little bit about that. This slide represents and shows you the impact from a health plan standpoint, assuming a 20% annual increase on the physician on an office visit side. And if health plans leave their copay structures the same to members, it shows you the leverage impact increase to the health plans, and that explains a lot of why healthcare costs keep going up, because health plans aren't changing the underlying rule. Then it kind of comes back to the entitlement that I have my $10 copay and don't change that for me. But then again, consumers don't really understand what's going on with the actual cost of their visits and those type of things. So that's a big part of it. How do we get to an HRA model from where we're at? And this is kind of a migration strategy that we've worked through. And it's taking their current plan of benefits and restating it typically to a high deductible plan. Typically, we look at when we reinstate those to a high deductible plan, most of those high deductible plans for it to work go to a 2,000 single 4,000 family type high deductible plan. And typically what we can see in a lot of cases with groups is by reinstating that to a $2,000 or $4,000 high deductible plan, we can yield some savings of about 15% to 25% in premium dollars. The employer then can use those savings and typically can use the majority or if not all of those savings that they've saved in fixed premium costs and fund an HRA account for their employers. We've seen many employers who convert to HRA type models into the first year either reduce their increase, so they might go backwards, which is not trend. Trends, you know, up 13-14%, or else they come out even by switching this. So they're not actually having an increase. And a lot of the groups that we've seen convert to these type of models, they don't increase employee contributions the first year because they're not having an impact to their bottom line costs because they're coming out either neutral or ahead in these type of model changes. So that's kind of the typical model that we use to design that. When we talk about plan design, and plan design is critical to these type of models, and we really feel there's a lot of different types of models that people can take out there, but we really feel it's important, especially on the RX side, and we believe still that it does cost an employer a little bit more in a premium standpoint, maybe 1 or 2 percentage points higher, but to keep that drug card valid for employers. And we don't run the RX through their HRA account. So if they have an incentive account and they have a reimbursement account, if you have people that are on maintenance drugs and it might cost them $200 a month or $250 a month, they're going to burn through their reimbursement or their savings account pretty quick. So we keep that outside of there, and we run it through a drug card, and we put in incentives for lower copays for generic brands and higher copays for brand drugs and then some mail order options, and try to incent people through generic and brand drugs by differentiating those copay amounts between those to try to shift people to generic drugs and start engaging their physicians on asking questions, is there a generic drug available? Start looking at information out there for comparing the cost of those. But don't punish someone because they're on a maintenance drug and they'll have no way to save their incentive account because they'll utilize that savings account every single year by just taking one maintenance drug. So it's keeping that thing outside of there. There are models out there that will run everything through the HRA, including drugs, and we feel as we design plans that puts some employees at a disadvantage for this. Design a preventative care plan. We think this is a really important piece of HRA. If you're going to engage consumers and give them incentive accounts, you also want to engage them in taking care of themselves, eating healthy, exercising, and getting annual tests done or physicals done or those type of things, and putting preventative care programs in, and again, keeping those outside of the HRA account. If someone goes and gets an annual physical, don't take that from their savings account. Pay for that separate on a plan. Have that covered at 100% and keep incenting people to go take care of themselves and do their preventative care type things. That's a big piece of these type of models. And then you get into the plan design of the HRA. And as we talked about before, and typically the HRA is going to be a book liability for an employer, and there are some exceptions with funding vehicles with that, but it's typically paid out at the time of the claim. So it's an account established. An employer determines an HRA amount, typically 50% of the deductible. A lot of the plans that we see that go to a $2,000, $4,000 deductible typically have a $1,000 HRA, $2,000 HRA incentive account built in the front of those. Where the HRA is paying the first dollar coverage for any expenses up to that amount and then rolls into an out-of-pocket situation. We believe strongly, too, that eligible expenses mirror the medical plan. That helps consumers engage in setting up still FSA accounts and those type of things and using other vehicles for eyeglasses, contacts, and those type of things.
Excuse me. Representative
Huntley. Mr. Chair and Mr. Preby?
Yeah.
Clarification, if let's say you have a $2,000 individual, a $4,000 deductible part of this, then how much is the HRA going to be for in those two cases?
Yeah, Representative Huntley and Mr. Chairman, the HRA is determined by the employer, and that's one of the neat things about the HRA model is that it fits a lot of different models out there from a financial standpoint for employers. And when you sit down and look at it with an employer, and that's where we talk about that plan migration and yield savings from premium, and then also we've had employers who have maybe built up reserves over the years and want to share more money back to their employees. We've had employees, so it's really determined by that employer. The typical model we look at is about 50% of that deductible. So But the HRA really can be determined by the employer in what meets the financial needs within that employer. We've had employers who have passed out HRA amounts that cover almost all of the deductible. And we sit in employee meetings, and employees, you hear them talking, and they ask in their employer, how can we afford to do this? And it's actually reducing costs on the employer side, and the employees don't really see that. But to them, it's a perceived and is actually a better benefit than what they had today. So depending on the financial model within an organization, they have complete freedom in that HRA design to design an HRA mechanism and design incentives and rollovers and whether they put vesting schedules or all kinds of different things into that HRA.
I'm just going to add one thing, too, is that one of the models, the typical model in the first year of an HRA plan is to keep the employees at the same or better maximum out-of-pocket that they have currently under the current plan, so that it's not a huge jump in terms of and what you're typically doing is, you are eliminating any office copays and 90-10 issues that they typically have now under their HMOs or PPO plans. Now they have 100% coverage of those dollars available under the HRA, again, an incentive for them to monitor those dollars. But from an employee's out-of-pocket or expense basis, there's no rule or law that says an employer has to fund 50% or 80%. It's just that's a typical model.
Well, then, Mr. Chair, and to either one of you, then it seems to me that for the typical case, if there was a $2,000 deductible for an individual, the HRA would be $1,000, so that the person would have, if he got sick or whatever, would have about $1,000 out of pocket. And if mm-hmm. it was a family, typically they'd have $2,000 out of pocket.
And it would Ms. be very similar to what they had before. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. Proceed. And to just continue on that, we'll talk about the plan. And part of that HRA is to build incentives into there so that we do get better behavior and engage the consumers in allowing them to roll some dollars forward into the future to cover that $1,000 gap that they might have out of pocket. So we build an incentive and they can start rolling some of those dollars over. Maybe in the next year their out of pocket expense is going to be $500, not $1,000, because they've been wise about how they've used those dollars. In the plan design itself, in the medical plan design itself, and it depends now in whether you're obviously a fully insured or you're in the self-funded ERISA environment. In the ERISA environment, on the self-funded side, you have a little more leeway in your plan design. But typically, it's going back to a high deductible plan, and the HRA is funding a portion of that deductible. As mentioned before, the out-of-pocket expenses, we look at that when we set up a plan and talk to an employer. The goal is to not to create more of an out-of-pocket expense than what an employee has today in their traditional plan. It's to mirror that or reduce that. In a lot of cases, we've actually been able to reduce out-of-pocket expenses and save the employer dollars and build in incentive accounts. But we've had a lot of incidents where plans have gone from typical copay type plans to 90-10 type medical plans, where the plan's paying 90% and a person's paying 10% coinsurance, to HRA plans with an out-of-pocket and then 100% plan after that. So we've been there's a lot of different things you can do in creativity to create a better plan, because you're raising and saving dollars on those premiums. But really, the freedom back on the backside then is to choose, do you want 100% plan?
Mr. Peavy, can I just make sure that I've got the right understanding when you say maximum out-of-pocket? That's sort of the maximum out-of-pocket for the person that experiences the most medical care. If you were one of those people who's on the very left edge of one of those charts you had that had only a couple of $100 expense, you wouldn't probably mirror what you might have had
right.
for out-of-pocket. You'd probably be less out-of-pocket.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, you're exactly right. If in today's, in this model with the HRA, if I'm one of those typical 80% of the people who has an expense under the $1,000, I'm not going to incur any out-of-pocket expenses.
Right.
That's going to be paid at first dollar through my HRA. And even if I have a couple $100 a year, I'm still going to have dollars at the end of the year to roll forward and keep moving and building into my incentive account. So you're exactly right in that design.
Thank you.
There's a lot of different options in the ERISA side, and then it's also within the fully insured world. It's looking out there and seeing what the carriers have to offer and looking at those plans and then building an HRA model in front of that. This is how it looks, kind of an example of how it looks when we look at a current plan in the migration. And this slide can represent and show you how over the course of 3 years, if you do have good behavior and build into your incentive account, and how you close that gap from your out-of-pocket expense down over the years. So as an employee for making wise decisions and saving some of those dollars, you eventually close the gap and could have potentially no out-of-pocket expense. There's a lot of other options.
Irvin Huntley?
Would it be possible to, like, maybe tomorrow have some reproductions of this that we could read? Because at least for me,
The dark areas are really important. We'll work on that. This is important information, and I don't know. It's a little tricky because the charts are dark, and when you copy it, we'll try to figure something out.
Get some color copies so you can see them.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, but in our budget?
we'll send them over.
Yeah, we'll work out something. can you provide us color?
We'll clean it up and reduce the background.
Just for this group, yes.
We'll clean that up and get it over.
Great, thank you.
Some of the other things you can do with HRA plan designs, and one of the things that's important is remember that it's, first and foremost, it's always thought about administering over a high-deductible medical plan. There are other options out there. We're starting to see groups migrate dental plans to HRA concepts, which are working great, where employers are giving employees dollars for dental coverage and letting them determine what they want to spend those dollars on. So in a typical dental plan today, you might only have 50% restorative type coverage. If that's important to you and you need that type of coverage, you might have all your dollars available for that now. So there's a lot of creative things you can do within those designs. Pharmacy HRAs, we see some of those. In our model, we believe keeping the pharmacy out of it in providing those coverages and controlling it through generic and brand type copays and not punishing people for maintenance types drugs and those things. But those are options. And then HRAs in conjunction with VIVAs. As you roll in HRAs with VIVAs, you can start to do some creative things. VIVA is a voluntary employee benefit association, and it's a 501c9 trust. It's another mechanism for an employer to set up dollars on a tax-free basis and save dollars in pre-fund accounts and those type of things. So it's just another vehicle to fund these type of HRAs and put in conjunction with longer saving type things for employees.
Mr. Beebe, in the interest of full disclosure, if you go back to the prior chart, I just want to make sure that my recollection is correct on the one that had the bar.
This bar diagram.
Yeah. Okay. As I understand, in the HRA model, I think you said it, but just so members understand it, that those accounts that are growing and are rolling over are still, in a sense, the property of the employer. These are not portable that if you went to some other company or something, which is different than you'll talk about HSA. But am I correct in that?
Mr. Chairman, yeah, you're exactly correct. These are employer-owned dollars. There is the eligibility. COBRA does apply to the HRA, so if you are a person who is COBRA eligible, you can continue COBRA and continue on your HRA
Thank
plan.
You.
But it is not portable and does not move with you.
Representative Huntley?
But, Mr. Chair, it does collect interest.
No.
Is that correct?
No.
It does not collect interest, no. With a VIVA, though, model, there is potential for that in the trust model to collect interest. But, again, that would be dollars. It would be employer dollars, and the employer would own that interest.
Thank you. Representative Trumba.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you have all these acronyms, health savings account in addition to your HRA?
Mr. Peavy?
Yeah, Representative and Mr. Chair, we'll talk a little bit about that and how those combinations work. We're still waiting for some clarification on how those things work in relation to the high deductible plans, and we'll talk, and as I go through this, we'll talk a little bit more of how the HRA and HSA and FSA kind of come together and can work.
And why don't we defer that, and you can see how the explanation works out. Representative Sanderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question. What would the benefit to the employee be if the employer maintains the HRA and there's no pot of gold at the end of the rainbow?
Mr. Beebe?
Representative, Mr. Chairman. Well, the employer does own the HRA. We have employers that have looked at that model and said, how do we incent employees and how do we get them involved in this? And employers are doing payouts. You can't by law, you can't do a payout under the HRA plan, but you can do, you can look at balances and say, we'll pay it out of general funds or those type of things. So employers are doing those type of things out there. They're being creative in how they structure those models. You can use HRA for premiums as well. So you can build in type things for retirement coverage. So if you have a retirement plan and people are saving an incentive, they can save those dollars and use those for retiree premiums and those type of things as they retire from plans. So there's a lot of different models out there that you can do things to reward the employees, even though it is an employer owned account. So employers are being creative with that. And we look at that as well. We've had employers who have had conversations with employees and have traded healthcare savings dollars for actually salary increases. They might sit down with an employee and say, you're going to have a 5% increase this year. I can give you 2% of that on a tax-free basis and put it into an incentive account or a savings account for healthcare, and I can give you 3% of it back to you in wages. Employers are being creative with those type of models and designs within the HRA.
Yeah, Mr. Beebe, I know Olmsted Medical Center presented to us before, and probably one of the most creative in recent times that I've seen anyway. In their case, they found a way at the end of each year to give back half of whatever is remaining in their account.
Yeah.
In cash, yeah. Which is wow.
Mr. Chairman, yeah, they, that is one of our clients, and they are giving back to their employees half of their balance taxable. So that is one of the more aggressive ones, and that was actually one of the ones where the employee meetings and the employees actually said to them, how can we afford this benefit plan? And Olmsted is actually saving dollars. So that's the neat part about these plans. They provide a lot of benefit.
Okay, please proceed.
Some of the current challenges that we're facing with the HRA models in consumers are facing is cost disclosure by providers. Consumers have many challenges when finding out healthcare costs. Cindy has a great example. I tell the story a lot. When we put an HRA plan in, she had to have a test done, and she was standing, and if you knew her, you'd know this. She was standing in the billing office in her hospital gown behind a billing person, asking him what the price of this procedure was that she had to have done, because no one could tell her the cost and had to go all the way down to the billing level. And people just can't get costs out there. Even as an administrator, and we see costs come through.
I think Cindy's a lot more colorful in telling this story.
Yeah, well, the answer I got four times was, well, don't you have insurance? When I wanted to know what it would cost. And so it was basically, if you have insurance, it's free, was their concept.
Right. So that's a challenge right now, is getting cost disclosure out there. But adding the cost disclosure in there, in a lot of what the last presentation was about, was talking about quality measures, setting national or regional or state standards that measure quality and outcomes of providers, so that individuals or consumers can have a place to go, whether it's via the web or somewhere, to go out there and say, this facility provides excellent care in lung transplants or hip replacements, and their outcomes are great, and that the cost, here's the cost, and now I can start to shop around. And a lot of procedures and a lot of things in healthcare, you're not going to shop around. We talked about that with employees. If you're having a heart attack, you're not going to pick up the phone and figure out what facility is going to get. You're going to dial 911. You're going to go to the hospital. But if you have things where you can prepare for things, if you know you're going to have a hip replacement surgery or a knee surgery or those type of things where you have time to do that, and you have tools out there that you can start to measure outcomes and values and those type of things and price, people are going to start to get engaged with those things if they're talking about their dollars.
Mr. Chair.
Just a comment about the cost, just to make it more difficult. It sounds like it should be easy to know what something costs, but whoever reimburses something reimburses at a different price. There are any two plans that reimburse a procedure for the price, and most of them discount it 10 to 40%. And so when someone asks me, what does it cost? I say, well, what plan do you have? And it's not that I'm going to change your price. We bill at a certain rate that maybe a few would pay, but most of them have a deep discount. So that's part of the struggle as you go through cost, too, as you advance.
Exactly. Representative Huntley?
Well, that's a fundamental question I have about this, and I was going to ask it again, but since it kind of came up. HRA part of this, when you're there negotiating the price, do you, asking what the price is, do you get the discounted price of the plan, or do you just pay what the physician or hospital decides to charge you?
That's a fair question.
which nobody else pays except somebody that's paying that doesn't have insurance.
Mr. Phoebe. Representative Chairman, that's a great question. We really think it's in design, in model, and how you pay those bills. We've gone to great lengths to integrate the HRA and the medical plans together so that when a claim comes through and when a member goes to the doctor today, it's no different than when they went to the doctor yesterday and had a copay plan. They still present their ID card. Their ID card explains to the provider where those claims go, if they belong to a network or if they don't belong to a network. Those claims come into our office and are all adjudicated into the same system. It's just what bucket of money is that claim paid out of at that time when it comes into our system. So, and then an EOB or payment goes back to the provider. So, yeah, we haven't seen issues with providers on a large scale not taking discounts. Now, in most of the contracts written out there, we've understood that we've had groups that go even to a $250 deductible, and many providers will make individuals pay up to that $250 right when they come in the office because they have a $250 deductible. So there are some providers out there that just practice the fact that if you have a deductible, no matter what that amount is, $250 or $2,000, they're going to make you pay up front if you haven't satisfied your deductible. It doesn't matter what health plan or what negotiated contract service you're in. There are some providers that practice that.
Ms. Rappel, do you have a point?
Yeah, I just want to add one more. Your question about do they get the discounted price is that, again, it depends on the provider and whether there's an HRA or not. What we're seeing is that they, if they ask for payment up front or they give you a price, it's typically without the discount, and then the discount is then it's an adjustment made on the back end. That's what we're having to do now with some of the providers out there because they're wanting the full amount up front. And what we're trying very hard to do is that when they call into customer service and what is our plan is if we say it's a $2,000 deductible, but there's $1,000 or $1,500, whatever their HRA account available up front 100%, then they don't require the payment and they give them the discount right out of the chute. It's more administration on the back end, but it's a total education in terms of the administration, but yeah, the discount, they do get it, but it may be an adjustment.
Well, if I've understood right, then you're getting the price that the major medical plan that you supplement
yeah.
gets.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
That Thank is you. What you're getting.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. And we have also found it's very interesting with the provider community. We have, when we talk about freedom of choice and restrictive networks, we have often a lot of people who may travel, and so they're outside of their network. And it's amazing how many times you can just pick up the phone and you can say to the provider, you have a $10,000 bill, and you can say to them, I'll give you $3,000 today. Will you accept it? Yeah. Okay. So the negotiation power is huge out there in the provider community, and there's a lot of business and things spawning up around just negotiating claims and those type of things. So,
excuse me, Mr. Freeby, it's our fault, but we're down to about 7 minutes, and I really want to be sure we get a chance to talk about HSA. So yep. Can we move forward, please?
Okay. And that's where we're at next. It's kind of a new twist in the health savings account. As many of you know, the effective date was 1/1/04, and it's an HSA is in an Archer MSA-like trust established by an individual eligible individual or by an employer for an eligible individual. And it's for the purpose of paying qualified medical expenses of that eligible individual or their eligible dependents. Different twists in the HRA. Remember before the HRA was employer-owned, the HSA is now employee-owned. And that effective date was 1/1/04, so there's still a lot of new things and designs and things on it. But just to give you some of the requirements into that, it's limited to individuals covered by a statutorily defined high deductible program, and that's HDHP, and it's not covered, an HDHP cannot cover by any other health plan providing the same benefit. They may be covered under and permitted insurance in addition to a high deductible health plan. HSAs are not limited to individuals or small employers. In the past, MSAs were limited to small employers 50 or below. HSAs are now open to any size employer, any individual that meets the definition of a high deductible health plan. HSA contributions can come from both employers and eligible individuals or both, so they can come from a combination of both or one or the other. Employer contributions are excluded from income. Individual contributions are deductible to the extent that contributions do not exceed certain monthly limitations, and we'll talk about those monthly limitations. It may be included in a cafeteria plan design, and employees can use pre-tax contributions to put dollars into the HSA. Unused contributions roll over from year to year and are portable. That's another big difference from the HRA. This is 100% rollover. The employer doesn't control 50% or 75% rollover, and it is also portable. So if I leave, I take these dollars with me. HSA, and that's one of the things we just talked about. The HSA distributions are excluded from gross income to the extent they are for approved medical expenses. Medical care is defined under Section 213, so the same expenses eligible under an HRA plan are eligible under 213. Non-medical distributions are included in gross income and are usually subject to a 10% tax.
Excuse me, this could be Representative Trumbo had a question.
This is really good. I think this is really good information, Mr. Chair, but you're going really fast, and so I'm not doing all the calculations as fast as you're going. And I know it's getting toward the end, but my first question is, can you do an HSA and a pre-tax?
HSA pre-tax. Yeah, you can roll it in.
I'm asking, can you have the HSA plus have
the HRA?
The flex.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm gonna get to that real quick.
Okay.
And how that works. There's some issues around that. The key elements of a high deductible health plan, the structure of it is that the annual deductible is not less than $1,000 for individual coverage or $2,000 for family coverage. The sum of the plans for an annual deductible and out-of-pocket cannot exceed $5,000 for an individual or $10,000 for family coverage. Preventative care is excluded from the deductible requirement. That means if you have 100% preventative care, it doesn't count against that. One of the challenges we're faced right now with this design and the requirements under it is the RX. Right now, the RX has to be subject to the deductible. There is some clarification. The month of January was a question clarification period coming back, and that was one of the concerns, is that why does the RX have to be subject to the deductible? Can't we run it outside on a drug card? So we're waiting, and hopefully that will get changed, that they could set up a drug card program outside of that where it's not subject to the deductible. But right now, drugs are subject to the deductible and fall in the health claim. You can have larger non-network deductibles and out-of-pocket expenses in your plan design. Types of insurance that fall under this are workers' compensation, tort liability, insurance for specified diseases, cancer insurance policies, transplant, those type of things, hospital indemnity plans, accident, disability, dental, vision, or long-term care plans are qualified under these. This is what we'll talk about, ineligible individuals. And individuals that fall into one of these following categories may not participate in an HSA. If you're covered under a spouse or dependent employer's health plan and that spouse's plan is not a high deductible health plan, you can't participate. Individuals covered under a comprehensive individual medical policy and other coverage is not a high deductible health plan. And this is where it addresses the HRA or FSAs are okay unless it provides coverage underneath a high deductible health plan minimum deductible. And we're waiting for clarification on that and how that works. So does that mean that we can't provide coverage, that HRA or that FSA can't provide coverage for that first deductible level? And does it have to go to the HSA? The IRS has been clear within the HRA and FSA in your medical plan that you have to distinguish the payment order of those plans. So that's kind of what we're waiting for, clarification on what do they mean by this and what's going to be the ordering of those plans. So that's still one of those outstanding issues on how that actually is going to shake out.
Mr. Chair.
Oh, Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Preby, how could workers' comp fit into this in terms of state law, which how could the employee own part of it when the employer has to pay 100%?
Yeah, Mr. B, I don't know if we have too much time. I've talked already with some of the people in Minnesota, and they don't think they can make an HSA work with at least our state law. Some of that's state by state, probably.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, this is just a federal overview.
Yeah.
And there are certain restrictions in the state that may not work for certain coverages here. Trust requirements. The HSA does require to sit in trust. The trustee can be a bank, an insurer, another person or entity capable of satisfying Treasury Department HSA requirements. No part of the trust in a life insurance contract. Assets are not commingled with other property and common trust investments. And a participant or an account beneficiary has a non-forfeitable interest to account balances. Some of the tax treatments of the HSAs, deductions cannot exceed the monthly limitations. The monthly limitation cannot exceed 1/12 of the following. In 2004, the lesser of the high deductible health plan deductible or $2,600 for a single person. Family is the lesser of the high deductible health plan family deductible or $5,150. There is an additional contributions allowed for individuals 55 or over. In 2004, that's $500, and that's going to be increasing $100 a year up to the year 2009. Your maximum deduction may be reduced by the amount that you might have contributed to a Archer MSA during that taxable year. So if you've converted from an MSA to an HSA plan, that's going to have some impact. And amounts contributed to an HSA by an employer which have been excluded from income. Excess contributions are subject to a 6% excise tax. Rollovers in the HSA are tax-free to the beneficiary, and balances are transferable for divorce, separation, or death on a tax-free basis. Some of the outstanding issues that we're still waiting for clarification to come through on, does ERISA apply to the HSA models, annual reporting requirements, DOL claims rules apply, COBRA issues, and does HIPAA apply with this? So we're still waiting for some clarification on how these come back, on how the FSA and the HRA is going to be able to design together, but we do see a future for the HSAs and another model for employers to use to help establish savings accounts that become portable, that people can carry with them throughout their life and establish dollars to use for eligible medical expenses.
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Reby, one of the things that that I've read, actually even about MSAs, but looks like HSAs even more, is that there's a very high proportion of people who've adopted these who were uninsured before. And it would look like in the HSA that that this design, particularly I think with Trumba's interest in a lot of us and farmers and other kinds of things, where the individual is empowered, if I'm understanding it, to design a plan. Is that likely that maybe this is something that, I mean, it's no silver bullet, but that this might become attractive to sort of people who are uninsured?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, you're exactly right. The nice thing about these designs are that people can go out and purchase high deductible plans that's going to give them catastrophic type coverage, but the premiums are going to be substantially lower. So maybe some of those dollars that they might have paid in premiums out to a carrier, they can start putting away into a savings account, and an individual can establish these health savings accounts to help them cover maybe that deductible in future years. So it does actually give individuals more of the ability to go out there and find a high deductible plan and start saving to cover some of those first dollar expenses over the course of time. So it is a nice vehicle for both individuals and employer groups to help save some dollars, but give the dollars back to the employees.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple things in that same light. I'd also like to know, like for people who are self-employed and they're going out and purchasing their own insurance policy, how they find out which one is the 40%, because that's part of our consumer saving health care too, the 40% deduction. Like if you're in a Blue Cross Blue Shield, it's pretty much an automatic 40% deduction of your health care. And so I'd like to see some of those benefits go along with that instead of them coming in with their individual health policy and having to pay 100%. And secondly, if it's okay with the chair, I would ask that when some of these answers are found, and when they that for Mr. Preby to come back and in more detail give us some of the decisions that have been made by the IRS. And
yeah, I think we'll try to keep in touch. We may or may not have the luxury of taking additional hearings because I think we're going to start filling up. But I think there's lots of people with their fingers on what's happening at HSA, and as more information comes to you and to others, we certainly would look for feedback.
And if, Mr. Chair, if we can't come in front of committee, then I'd be more than willing to have you set up some sort of informational meetings for us to attend because this is it's complicated, but it's necessary, and to know what to recommend is impossible just yet without the final numbers. Thank you.
Just to refine one more, it seems to me that also this brings a notion of a potential tax equity that we don't have today.
Mm-hmm.
There are people today that can't get at the market with pre-tax dollars like they can if they have their employer. Is that also correct?
It is correct. I mean, they're going to be able to save some dollars on a pre-tax basis.
Individually.
Individually, right. That's what I meant.
To establish these type of accounts.
Okay. Yeah. Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chair, and either one, my main concern about either HSAs or HRAs is the effect on people that have chronic illnesses and are always going to hit the max every year, as they should. I mean, if you're you have a pretty severe case of diabetes, you better be spending $5,000 a year, or you're not getting treated right. So it looks like in the HRAs, the typical ones, I guess the difference in what employees get versus that are sick versus healthy are would be at a level that even I might tolerate. So that's where I'm coming from on this decision I make on this. But in HRAs, with HSAs, the employer has to set the money aside in a separate account. And then my concern here, again, is that we all know how pensions have been underfunded, causing many people, when they retire, to find out they don't have any pension. And so if they're counting on this HSA when they retire, the way I look at it, it looks like the federal government and their new rules say that the money has to be set aside.
Mr. Quigley?
Representative, Mr. Chairman, yes, it does have to be set aside in a trust. That trust can either be through a bank or a qualified entity that's eligible to maintain those trusts. And those dollars do have to be funded on a monthly basis. So it's 1/12 of that contribution has to be funded if the employer is contributing to that into that trust on a monthly basis. So they do have to set those dollars aside each month.
In the HRA, Mr. Chair, either one, since the employee owns the money that's sitting in the account, I assume they don't have to put it into a separate account. But what if there's an understanding, what would happen if there's an understanding that when the person retires or leaves the company, he gets half of it or whatever the arrangements were? When that employee goes to leave and the company's bankrupt, there won't be money there that he thought he was going to get. So there is no requirement in the HRAs that it be set aside.
Mr. Beebe?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, there is no requirement to date. We do strongly recommend that companies that are establishing HRAs that they put it in some sort of trust and they do fund it. Some employers, and it works a lot like self-funded insurance, employers who have been in that environment for many years build up reserves and understand and have their cash flow situated so that they don't have to fund those type of things and they have reserves built up. So there are different mechanisms within the HRA versus the HSA to fund that. And back to your comment about the people with high dollar utilization or types of illnesses and those type of things with the HRA or the HSA model, these are vehicles where they're going to have some dollars to be incentive, and hopefully they're going to go out and search for better care and take better care of themselves so they can start to build into those savings accounts. And it's not going to impact them any more out of pocket than it does today. But it gives them that incentive to know that today my health plan is use it or lose it, tomorrow it's use it or keep it. And so if I'm incented to take care of myself better, I might be able to save some more of those dollars in the future. So.
And they're going to have to cut us off. Chairman Seagren just came in the room, and I know I better get out of here. We adjourn.
He relies on.